That's STI screenings, that's well woman visits. In many places, it's general primary health care, and the safety net for health care for many Americans, not just women, but all families. They're estimating 200 clinics to close nationwide should this bill go down, should this bill pass the Senate. In addition, you've got hospital systems lobbying against this bill. You've got insurance providers lobbying against this bill because this bill would also just decimate healthcare infrastructure well beyond family planning services. When that happens, the poorest of Americans who need these services, but also a lot of Americans who are getting these services who might not realize when they go to Planned Parenthood and they get the subsidized care, it's actually Medicaid, are going to be forced into our nation's ERs. They're going to be forced into other clinics. They may not get care at all. And that will have a dramatic impact on all Americans, regardless of where you get their health care, because it will decimate the larger health care
We
system
only
in this
have 20
country.
seconds. How are you fighting back?
We are lobbying aggressively the U.S. Senate. We are, as you know, we've launched these ads. We are organizing on the ground. We're working with partners like Monica and her team in Georgia. And we will be making sure Americans in those states realize that come 2026, if they've decimated Medicaid, there will be hell to pay.
Mini Timaraju, President of Reproductive Freedom for All, and Monica Simpson, Executive Director of Sister Song. That does it for our show. We're hiring a senior headline news producer, a director of audience, and a director of technology. To find out about all three jobs, go to democracynow.org/jobs. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Jewish-Palestinian Alliance of Oregon, presenting a benefit concert for the people of Gaza on Friday, May 30th at the First Unitarian Church. All proceeds will support the Palestine Children's Relief Fund, which provides medical care to children from Palestine, as well as direct aid to Gaza. Tickets and info at jpao.org/events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, local environmental organization 350PDX has to find alternative funding as major grant foundations, quote, change priorities. As Multnomah County confronts major budget cuts, the Office of Sustainability could face closure. And in national news, NPR sues Trump. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 27th, 2025. I'm Hannah Francis. One local Portland climate justice organization is in dire financial straits, according to a recent email from its director. 350PDX, Portland's local hub of the International 350 organization, faces a budget crisis that could mean an end to their operations. They are most recently known for their successful pressure on city council to perform an investigation on fossil fuel company Zenith Energy that is storing and transporting fossil fuels through Portland. The organization announced last week that they have to raise $150,000 by August 1st or risk losing their space, their paid staff members, or at worst, closing their doors entirely. They state, quote, big wealthy foundations don't typically support this type of work, and the grants landscape has changed dramatically. They say that several of their largest funders have redirected their grants, leaving the organization with half the size of their annual budget. The campaign director for 350PDX, Deneen Crow, says the organization is already doing as much as possible to cut costs. They have closed their office space to save money and decided not to rehire recently vacated positions. 350PDX does not receive funds from the larger national organization of 350.org. Rather, each offshoot of this organization funds their work separately. Instead, Director Crow says, individual donors are the most consistent and reliable source of funding for the organization. emerald ash borers will continue their rapid spread across the U.S. The ash borers have already killed hundreds of thousands of ash trees since their discovery in 2002. KBOO's Lexis Ponce reports.
Summer is fast approaching and emerald ash borers will soon be on the move and continue their rapid spread across the U.S. Emerald ash borers have already killed hundreds of millions of ash trees in North America and are continuing to expand in range. The emerald ash borer is an invasive pest. It was brought into the country and was found in Michigan in 2002. The emerald ash borer is a narrow, small little flat-headed borer beetle the size of a penny and are green and emerald color. The beetle has wreaked havoc and has cost billions of dollars throughout the Midwest and East Coast and was brought over the Rocky Mountains by someone carrying firewood. Typically, hot, dry summers are when they are flying around and infecting trees. Adults live for about a year and their larva will live in the tree for up to 2 years. Emerald ash borers only attack ash trees. Their larvae chew and feed on the vascular system of the tree, which stops nutrients and basically kills the tree immediately as they eat. Early identification is key. Here are some signs Michael Spalding from the Portland Davy Tree Expert Company says people should look out for.
First, you'll notice the thinning of the canopies in the top. You'll see dieback from the top down. On closer inspection, if you find dead broken branches that have fallen off, there's D-shaped exit holes about the size of a ballpoint pen tip, and that's where the larvae have emerged as adults, and then they fly out and they infest another tree. But you'll typically see the thinning in the tops, and then you'll notice a surge of sucker growth or small shoot growth from the base. It's trying to push new growth and obtain energy because the top of the tree is no longer producing energy for the tree because the vascular system has been eaten.
Without preventative care, infested trees may die within 3 years. There are several ways to prevent and stop the spread of an emerald ash borer.
First, I would recommend consulting with an arborist and having a tree inventory done of your property so that you know if you have ash trees, how many ash trees you have, and where they're located. And then for treatments, there's a few different methods of treatment. You can do some ground injections, which is probably your least effective and also environmentally unfriendly. But you can also do trunk injections. You would do those once every other year at a high rate. And you inject into the vascular system, it uptakes a chemical, and it protects the tree. If any pests chew in that, they die immediately. That's how you protect your trees.
Spalding recommends people do a Google search on emerald ash borers for more help and information on preventative care, measures they should take, and active studies happening on emerald ash borers. For KBOO News, I am Lexis Ponce.
Multnomah County is facing a budget shortfall, like many other counties and cities in Oregon. To fix it, county commissioners need to make cuts. But one possible reduction is getting pushback. Now, the Office of Sustainability at Multnomah County is facing budget cuts that could essentially put an end to its services. More than 40 local organizations have signed a petition opposing the cuts to the Sustainability Office. The petition says, quote, "These programs directly protect our communities from pollution, rising energy costs, and climate disasters like heat waves and wildfire," unquote. The Sustainability Office helps build pathways for Multnomah County to be 100% renewable by 2050. It also presented new possible laws to hold fossil fuel companies financially accountable for risks of oil and gas leaks during a major earthquake. But three county commissioners have proposed budget amendments that majorly scale back funding for the office. Commissioner Megan Moyer's proposal states that her amendment would, quote, "eliminate all but the lead position and assimilate the program under the Department of County Management." Other departments, including the Sheriff's Department and the District Attorney, are facing no budget cuts. Wednesday, May 28th, will be the third public hearing for the Multnomah County budget. On Thursday, the Office of Sustainability will present to the board at a meeting at 2:30 p.m. about its activities and budget requests. Advanced practice providers, including nurse practitioners, are a year into bargaining their first contract with Oregon Health and Science University. The union says workers are burnt out and need a better work-life balance. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
Oregon Health and Science University's Advanced Practice Providers, a title encompassing nurse practitioners, physician associates, and midwives, are negotiating their first contract. About 600 APPs statewide are represented by the Oregon Nurses Association. Chelsea Chapman, a physician associate in Klamath Falls and union member, says her team is frustrated with OHSU's slow progress after a year of bargaining. Chapman says APPs play a vital role in all healthcare settings, including hospitals, emergency rooms, and teaching. But the system does not value them enough.
They just are having difficulties understanding why providers are burnt out and why there needs to be changes. Because what we've been doing, the status quo, it's just not safe and it's not sustainable any longer.
OHSU says it does not have the money to meet the union's demands. Chapman counters, citing their plan to invest more than $1 billion into a legacy merger that fell through earlier this month. She says the union is focused on improving patient safety, quality of care, and providing retention. Chapman explains that defining workload is a big part of retention. She says APPs carry a heavy administrative burden long after they have left a patient, which is time they are not paid for.
We call it pajama time. So we're charting at home, we're answering my chart messages from home, and it's really contributing to burnout amongst all areas of medicine.
Chapman says Oregon can't afford to lose more providers amid a healthcare staffing shortage. Data shows the state needs 40% more primary care providers in the next decade to meet the need. Chapman adds that APPs can help as they are trained and certified faster than physicians. She says the union is urging OHSU to finalize the contract.
Working in rural Oregon, it really means the difference of us surviving the next 10 months versus being able to thrive and practice in primary care for the next 10 years.
One report shows that 70% of Oregon primary care providers reported stress and exhaustion in their practice at an all-time high. That's 10 points higher than the national level. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
National Public Radio, or NPR, just filed a First Amendment lawsuit against the Trump administration. NPR alleges Trump's attempt to defund the station is unconstitutional. Several NPR member stations from Colorado joined the national network in bringing forward the suit. The lawsuit, filed today in federal court in Washington, D.C., says Trump's actions against NPR violate, quote, the expressed will of Congress and the First Amendment's bedrock guarantees of freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of association, end quote. NPR added it, quote, threatens the existence of a public radio system that millions of Americans across the country rely on for vital news and information. Trump targeted NPR and its television counterpart, PBS, in an executive order signed on May 1st. He accused the public media outfits of bias and said the Corporation for Public Broadcasting must stop funding them. However, the president does not fund public TV and radio. Congress does. The funds for both have been allocated for decades, most recently in a bill that Trump signed into law earlier this spring. The corporation that distributes Congress's funding to public radio, CPB, is a private nonprofit corporation that is set up to be free of presidential interference. CPB previously filed its own lawsuit against Trump's attempt to fire three of its board members. Each year, the CPB disperses $535 million in taxpayer funds to public radio and TV stations nationwide and to producers of educational and cultural programming. During Trump's first term, he repeatedly tried to strip all funding from PBS and NPR. Now he continues his efforts, saying the networks, quote, spread radical woke propaganda disguised as news, end quote. Public media executives say this is a gross mischaracterization of what they actually do. Theodore Boutross, one of the attorneys representing NPR in the suit, believes that listeners are the ultimate victims of Trump's actions. He said today, quote, by seeking to halt federal funding for NPR, the executive order harms not only NPR and its member stations, but also the tens of millions of Americans across the country who rely on them for news and cultural programming and vital emergency information, end quote. PBS has also been preparing to take legal action, but has not yet filed a suit. President Trump remembers fallen soldiers and then touts his achievements. Israeli nationalists show disdain for Arabs in the streets, but a possible Gaza ceasefire may be on the table. Pro-democracy advocates call for civility and tolerance in politics. With those stories and more, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Their valor gave us the freest, greatest, and most noble republic ever to exist on the face of the earth. A republic that I am fixing after a long and hard 4 years.
After paying his respects to service members buried at Arlington National Cemetery, President Donald Trump criticized the previous administration. On social media, Trump had scathing words for former President Joe Biden and federal judges who've blocked many of his strict anti-immigration policies. According to research from the conservative Cato Institute, more than a fifth of the migrants so far sent to a high-security El Salvador prison actually entered the U.S. legally. In another post, Trump said Russian President Vladimir Putin had gone absolutely crazy after a weekend of relentless attacks on Ukrainian residential areas. Trump has so far not endorsed a European plan to increase sanctions on Russia. Israeli nationalists marked a holiday in Jerusalem by marching through Muslim neighborhoods chanting death to Arabs. Some in Israel's right-wing cabinet supported the marchers, but others have criticized them. Meanwhile, Hamas has said they have agreed to accept a 60-day Gaza ceasefire for hostages deal negotiated by the U.S. Israel has not signed on and has ordered evacuations from most of southern Gaza ahead of ground attacks. The budget and policy plan that passed the House could face an uphill battle in the Senate. Wisconsin GOP Senator Ron Johnson says there are enough Republicans to hold up Trump's big, beautiful bill over the $4.5 trillion it would add to the deficit. Joel Payne is with the progressive group Move On.
They're using that money to pay for billionaire tax cuts for people who don't need them and who not necessarily all of them actually ask for them. It's the height of irresponsibility.
One part of the bill would cut funding for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau by more than two-thirds. Alex Alvarez with Progress Arizona says the agency has already returned more than $20 billion to working families.
People are working harder than ever before, are seeing rising costs, and instead of giving any kind of support, this Congress is trying to aid the Trump administration's assault on the CFPB, which has returned $21 billion to defrauded consumers in the form of restitution or canceled debts.
Congress has voted to overturn a CFPB rule strictly limiting how much banks and credit card companies can profit from overdraft fees. Pro-democracy groups want to tone down America's heated political rhetoric. Some analysts doubt how far their efforts can go, but Emily Chamley Wright of the Institute for Humane Studies says as bad as things might feel right now, it doesn't mean America's falling apart. She says people have repeatedly come to see the value in our institutions.
We have this resilience baked in, but that doesn't mean that we can sit back and just wait for it either.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report. At 6, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be warm, reaching a high just about now of 80 degrees, low of 56 tonight. Tomorrow will be sunny with a high of 82 and a low of 56. Today in history, British punk band Sex Pistols released their second single in 1977, God Save the Queen, which was quickly banned by the BBC and other media outlets in England. The quote of the day is from 2004 film I Heart Huckabees. The public relations anti-hero says in a moment of existential dread, "How am I not me? How am I not me?" Colorado is joining the Eastern Shoshone Tribe in Wyoming in designating bison as wildlife. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Colorado is joining the Eastern Shoshone Tribe in Wyoming in designating bison as wildlife. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats reports.
Earlier this year, the Eastern Shoshone Tribe reclassified bison from being livestock to wildlife in an effort to manage the species less like cattle and more like big game. On Thursday, Colorado's governor signed the Protect Wild Bison Bill, which creates a dual wildlife and livestock designation. Conservation groups say it makes killing bison that cross into Colorado from other states illegal. Jason Baldus is Eastern Shoshone and heads up the Wind River Tribal Buffalo Initiative. He says Colorado's move shows growing public support for bison restoration.
And the importance of people allowing this animal to exist and not be commodified, but really have an opportunity to exist on the landscape.
Jim Magagna with Wyoming Stock Growers says if a similar bill were to be introduced in Wyoming, his group would oppose it.
I think we're a long ways from that. I can't say it'll never happen. Things do change, but I'm not aware of any pressure significant to do that in Wyoming.
Colorado's bill goes into effect in January next year. I'm Olivia Weeds at the Center of the West in Cody.
A Montana-based indigenous group says it's increasing membership this year in a new way, a traveling conference. Western Native Voice recently held the last of about a dozen conferences it hosted since March in tribal communities across the state. Kathleen Shannon has more.
The group offers programs to attendees that focus on leadership development, civic engagement and education, and public policy advocacy. Denise Juneau, Montana's former state superintendent of public instruction and a conference keynote speaker, says Native legislators made a lot of headway in this year's session.
There was a sense of pride in seeing what got accomplished through the 12 Native legislators who got elected from all these different communities. And I think really a glimmer of hope about what can happen when people get engaged.
Bills that passed include updates to the Montana Indian Child Welfare Act and a new approach to the missing and murdered Indigenous persons crisis, as well as reauthorization of Native language preservation programs and formal recognition of Indigenous Peoples Day. Juneau, an enrolled member of the Mandan Hidatsa tribes of North Dakota, credits her own success in part to growing up with parents in the state legislature and tribal leadership.
Being in those seats of power and speaking truth to power and being engaged at that level really makes a difference for your community, for your state, for the country, and for the people who are around you.
Yellowstone People's Executive Director Shane Doyle is a member of the Apsalika Nation. He says there's a common misconception that tribes across Montana were historically in conflict when evidence shows they were largely friendly.
Despite the enormous and remarkable language diversity here in Montana, the tribes were all able to coalesce over generations and create their own sign language. And it just is a testimony to their stable relations.
I'm Kathleen Shannon.
U.S. Senators Elizabeth Warren and Jeff Merkley and Congresswoman Jill Takuda have reintroduced the Remove the Stain Act. The bill seeks to revoke the Medal of Honor awarded to soldiers for their participation in the Wounded Knee Massacre on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota in 1890, where U.S. soldiers slaughtered hundreds of Lakota men, women, and children. 20 soldiers were awarded the Medal of Honor. According to Senator Warren, Congress has rescinded Medals of Honor before, and the bill would do the same, taking a step toward righting a wrong in history. In a statement, she said, "We cannot be a country that celebrates and rewards horrifying acts of violence against Native people. Congress must recognize how shameful this massacre was and take an important step toward justice for Lakota people." The legislation is supported by a number of tribes and Native organizations. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A free store helps hurricane survivors go solar in western North Carolina. The store connects people with equipment donated by solar companies in the wake of Hurricane Helene. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. After Hurricane Helene devastated western North Carolina last fall, donated supplies poured into the region, including solar panels, batteries, and other equipment that can help provide energy to areas without power.
A lot of these large solar companies, they'll make these very generous, large, in-kind donations of equipment after a storm.
But Catherine Hebson with the Footprint Project, a disaster recovery nonprofit, says there's a risk that some of this equipment will go to waste if it doesn't find its way to those who need it. So her group set up the Western North Carolina Free Store, which distributes some of the donated solar equipment.
And so then we're kind of taking it upon ourselves to be the matchmaker and get that equipment to somewhere where it's going to be used.
Some people are using the equipment for temporary power while they rebuild. Others are creating larger off-grid systems to provide reliable energy long-term.
Sometimes we just give an individual 10 panels or 4 MC4 cables because that's what they need to finish off their system.
So by getting donated equipment to where it's needed, the Free Store helps support communities' long-term recovery and resilience. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
The fallout from Trump's tariff hikes is extensive, ranging from low polling numbers to business uncertainty, declining customer confidence, price increases by most major retailers, and a loss of investor confidence. Trump's promise of a, quote, golden era is far from reality. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Discussion of President Trump's high tariffs is mostly about its international consequences, particularly for U.S.-China relations. But the consequences for the American public are just as significant. Trump is selling the tariffs as a path to another golden age. Quote, your paychecks will be higher, your streets will be safer and cleaner, your communities will be richer, and your future as an American will be much better than it ever has been when I get in, he said at his last campaign rally. That rosy view seems to be based on two core beliefs. First, that tariffs will repair the damage from the U.S. having been ripped off, and second, that the world needs the U.S. more than the U.S. needs the world. We're a department store, a giant department store, says Trump. Everybody wants to come in and take from us. But what I'm doing with the tariffs is people are coming in and they're building at levels you've never seen before. We have $7 trillion of new plants, factories, and other things, investment coming into the U.S., unquote. Actually, they're not. And it's we who are being ripped off. Time for a reality check. First, public opinion strongly opposes Trump's tariffs and his entire economic agenda. A Washington Post ABC News Ipsos national poll in late April found that 64% of Americans disapprove of Trump's tariffs, 34% approve. The Consumer Sentiment Index has fallen 30% since January, due mainly to the tariffs. Trump's handling of the economy, usually his strong suit, has only 39% approval. Second, businesses, consumers, and job holders are all victims of uncertainty. Businesses are undecided about how to respond and worried about what comes next. Companies with product orders in China, for example, are front-loading orders to take advantage of the 90-day pause reached in U.S.-China tariff talks. But after that, what? Concerns are widespread about supply chains and product shortages. We may be entering a period of more frequent and potentially more persistent supply shocks, a difficult challenge for the economy and for central banks, said the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell. We are starting to see the true impact of President Trump's tariffs on the supply chain, said Jonathan Gold, the National Retail Federation's Vice President for Supply Chain and Customs Policy. In the end, he said, these tariffs will affect consumers in the form of higher prices and less availability on store shelves. Trump's department store metaphor is not proving apt. Axios, for example, reports, quote, the CEOs of three of the nation's biggest retailers, Walmart, Target, and Home Depot, privately warned Trump in a meeting in late April that his trade policy could trigger massive product shortages and spice hikes. Walmart's chief executive followed up that warning with another in mid-May, saying that, quote, even at the reduced levels, the higher tariffs will result in higher prices. Trump falsely said those companies supported the tariffs, then admonished Walmart's CEO for blaming the tariffs. Walmart, said Trump, should eat the tariffs and not charge valued customers anything. Here are some other indicators of the negative consequences of the tariffs. Home sales are the lowest since 2009. Lawsuits challenging Trump's power to levy tariffs by decree are mounting from state officials, small businesses, conservative and liberal groups, and two Indian tribes. Tourism to the U.S. has dropped significantly, over 11% in March, especially from Europe and Canada. Import cargo traffic in the United States has dropped significantly. Ocean container bookings from China to the U.S. are down more than 60%. Container ship dockings in Los Angeles, the busiest U.S. port, dropped by over 40%. Dock workers there and at eastern ports expect major layoffs. Both international longshoremen's unions have issued harsh rebukes of the tariffs, which, as one said, quote, don't put America first, they put American working people last. And American scientists are on the trading block. The Trump-Doge team's firings of federal and university scientists and researchers have given the European Union an unexpected opportunity to hire them away. Third, new investments in U.S. manufacturing, such as from IBM and Taiwan Semiconductor, are mostly promises that we've heard before. The New York Times reported a different picture. Investors have grown increasingly wary of Trump's policies in recent months, with stocks, bonds, and the dollar all showing signs of weakness as fund managers fret over the uncertainty surrounding Trump's policymaking approach. The International Monetary Fund has sharply downgraded its outlook for the U.S. economy. In short, except for the super rich, there is no golden era, only hard times. And Trump cannot disguise that fact. He is making fewer grandiose promises and urging more caution, talking about a transition to better times, hinting that a recession might happen. But he cannot hide disastrous decision-making that will cost the Republicans dearly. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 27th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Lexis Ponce, Josh Salem, and Mel Gertov. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonio Gonzalez, Alex.